Our subject today, as I hope you have noted, is captioned "The Negro and Equal Justice." There can be no dispute in the minds of we attorneys about this in San Francisco, since we feel firmly that the Negro is receiving equal justice in our courts. If what is meant by this title, "The Negro and Social, Political, Economic, and Cultural Justice," then there exists a controversial issue, and a real one, which differs in the various areas of this United States of ours. It is contended by some that such equality can be gained by those seeking it as rapidly as they demonstrate their ability to adjust to surroundings and by the adoption of the standards of morality and respect for the law, which some people say is essential to the securing of what I have read in the papers as full or first-class citizenship. It is also contended that to attempt to force this status before earned creates resentment, that resentment creates hatred, which in turn creates violence. Thoughtful people, however, realize that lack of opportunity may result in cultural deprivation as well as economic, and that this is one of the greatest problems facing America today. Our speaker is an outstanding example of overcoming lack of opportunity. He comes from that underprivileged area where so many unfortunate events have recently occurred, Birmingham, Alabama. He studied at Harvard Law School, and he received his law degree from the University of Michigan. He has practiced law. He was formerly assistant district attorney under Pat Brown in San Francisco, and then clemency and extradition attorney for Governor Brown at Sacramento. At present, he is the U.S. attorney for the Northern District of California. Now, he has earned his honors and has become one of our esteemed and integrated citizens. It is my pleasure at this time to present to you our speaker, Cecil F. Poole.
Mr. Chairman, I thank you. And I thank all of you leftovers from last Friday when General Walker was here. In order that my other university not be entirely slighted, I'd like to supplement your bibliography by saying that I tarried long enough at Harvard to get a degree there also. I hadn't thought particularly about the added qualification that I might have to talk about this general subject based upon the fact that I was born in Birmingham. I am quite an expert on that city because I spent my first 4 years there. And therefore, I think that I might even write a book about it someday. I believe, by way of preface, that the generality of this subject is such that I would prefer to allow its outlines to be determined by the question and answer process more than by the prepared text which I will give to you. This is the custom of the Commonwealth Club. And in the, on the occasions when I have been here as a guest, I have found that the most illuminating parts of the speaker's subject were those which the audience itself drew forth from him by way of questions. But let me just launch into it in this manner. A few weeks ago, at the height of the Birmingham uprisings, Our two children, one 11, one 16, stared wonderingly at the television set, watching little Negro children 2,000 miles away shouting, "Freedom, freedom, freedom," as water hoses knocked people down like tenpins, and an armored car, the property of the Birmingham Police Department, rumbled menacingly and ponderously toward the retreating crowd like a nightmare out of Daryl Zanuck's The Longest Day. My younger child, not quite believing that this scene could be real, asked, "What do they mean by freedom?" I started a reply, but before I could form the words, the older girl, senior by 5 years, and already wiser to the heartache of her age, answered for me. "They mean," she said, "that they want to be treated like all people should be treated, and not just like they don't belong here." No words of sophistication I could ever assemble could convey more clearly the poignancy, the depth, the sincerity, and the simplicity of the Negro's weary search for equality of treatment, of opportunity, of justice in the land of his birth. The revolutionary history of the United States and its great declarations of national purpose and organization have all added up to the most solemn of commitments that the doctrine is self-evident, unequivocal, unending, that all men are created equal, that their Creator, by the act of their birth, endowed them with rights unalienable by government or otherwise, and that to them, as fully as to any others in our constituent society, this includes meaningful and dignified life, responsible and unfettered liberty, and within the general bounds of mutual rights and duties, the individual's pursuit of his own happiness. 100 years ago, Abraham Lincoln issued the Great Emancipation Proclamation, declaring that all persons held as slaves are and henceforward shall be free. And the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution were enacted to implement the proclamation's promise and to guarantee that the Negro, who, next to the American Indian and the settlers of Jamestown and Plymouth, is the oldest permanent immigrant in this country, that he would, in theory and in fact, be free. Critical students of history have suggested that the motivation of the war triumphant North in the 3 post-Civil War amendments was less charitable than I have stated, that they were aimed more at shackling the Southern people than at really unfettering the Negro people. Be that as it may, the rest of the century's history has been an agonizing and frustrating trek of a people toward full citizenship, full equality, full liberty under conditions of disadvantage and frequent despair, which only an isolated minority can ever know. And yet, the American Negro, because of his passionate belief, his need to believe in the elemental truth of his Declaration of Independence, his Constitution, and his democracy, has relied and insisted upon the hope that his own education and the consequent persuasion of whites would bring about that equality of status to which America is committed. He has pursued this course through the orderly procedures of the courts, seeking their declaration that due process was his as well as the right of corporations, that he was entitled to privileges and immunities which hostile Southern or indifferent Northern states were not constitutionally empowered to abridge. The Negro has had to seek the aid of the courts to establish his right to travel without being burdened and humiliated by having to ride in the dirty, dusty Jim Crow car coupled closest to the steam engine, where cinders and grime cover the floor and seats of the oldest equipment set aside for him pursuant to the hypocritical doctrine of separate but equal. He sought and obtained the judgment of the law that the state of Texas could not forbid him to cast his ballot in the primary, that Missouri could not bar him from its university, that Oklahoma could not make him sit behind a partition in class, that Louisville could not legally draw a line and decree what blocks were his to reside in, and that Tennessee and Georgia and Alabama and Florida and Mississippi could not beat him to the floor, hold him incommunicado, frighten him with threats of mob violence and lynching, deny him counsel, and thereafter return a legal conviction in the name of justice. The Negro has sought by the legal process to establish himself as entitled to security in his person, houses, papers, and effects, the same thing which one supposes had been settled by the British Parliament in the 18th century and confirmed once and for all in the 4th, 5th, and 14th Amendments to the Constitution. But for him, it was necessary to reassert, to have reconfirmed, and to repeat these basic guarantees. Why was this? Why was it necessary to redraw and redefine these painful lessons of history? It is because, for so long and in so many variant ways, the American Negro has been both America's cross and America's invisible man. The plain fact is that the South has scorned, bullied, and openly denied him citizenship, while the North has piously pointed to the legal and constitutional gains and pretended that the court-pronounced rights were being accorded to him, and shut its eyes, its ears, and its very heart to the flagrant and brutal repression which everywhere has been in evidence. Northerners and Southern liberals, some hopefully, some despairingly, have recited the long list of equal rights which the Negro has gained, have assured him that he has come a long way, that doors are opening everywhere, that it takes time, or that the time isn't quite right, or that this or that Negro, a real leader, is a credit to his people because he was the first, and usually the only, member of his race to receive this or that honor or position. Northern whites point accusing fingers at the South where discrimination and second-class citizenship are overt, sanctioned by custom, law, and the armed might of the community. And they preen themselves and flick the dust from the hem of the Pharisee's robe as they remind him that here in the North and West, he can eat at the lunch counter, borrow books from the public library, vote, sit in the park, try on a suit of clothes, sleep at a hotel, ride anywhere in the bus. These are important rights. Make no mistake. They make life more abundant, more enjoyable, more free. But the North, which readily agrees that the Constitution means what it says, still persists in the philosophy that integration means legal theory and not practice in the fundamentals without which no one can be free or integrated. It has persisted in handling him as the invisible man about whom author Ralph Ellison wrote in his book, as if in the midst of national and international dialogues about the rights of mankind, the Negro is in another room or even in another country. And so it is with this background of indifference, hostility, and denial that the Negro, who has heretofore been a national problem for discussion of sociologists, social planners, and police, has now become suddenly, as it were, a national revolutionary. Birmingham was not the start, but only the signal fire. North and South, the burning proceeds. For in both North and South, the end product has been basically similar. In the South, the Negro fights to vote. North, he fights for a job, for decent housing, for a meaningful role in his government, and promised these in theory, but denied them in fact, he has come to the ominous place described on June 12, 1963 by President John F. Kennedy in these words: "The fires of frustration and discord are burning in every city, North and South, where legal remedies are not at hand. Redress is sought in the streets, in demonstrations, parades, and protests, which create tensions and threaten violence and threaten lives. We face, therefore," the president said, "a moral crisis as a country and as a people. It cannot be met by repressive police action. It cannot be left to increased demonstrations in the streets. It cannot be quieted by token moves or talk. It is a time to act in the Congress, in your state and local legislative body, and above all, in all of our daily lives. It is not enough," the president said, "to pin the blame on others, to say this is a problem of one section of the country or another, or to deplore it. The fact that we face a great change is at hand, and our task, our obligation, is to make that revolution, that change, peaceful and constructive for all. Those who do nothing are inviting shame as well as violence. Those who act boldly are recognizing right as well as reality." Many Americans have been shocked and disturbed by the clear-cut analyses of James Baldwin. They tend to think of him as angry. They ask other Negroes whether, for example, San Francisco can become another Birmingham. Let me read to you the words of Eric Severide from a local San Francisco newspaper of last Sunday. Quote, "However painful this is for most of us, the plain truth is that the American Negro has, at long, long last, lost faith in the white man and his society. He no longer believes the words of promise. He no longer believes that the laws will be enforced unless he himself forces their enforcement. This is what the most patient and enduring of American races has come to. And we who are white have no one to blame but ourselves. There is no place to hide anymore." End of quote. No, there is no place to hide, but there is no need to hide. For if the American white sees desperation in the demonstrations and self-help which this year has brought, he should also see the natural answer to these outcries for equal opportunity and equal justice. Labor unions should see it. Business should see it. Government should see it. The answer is, let us tear down these barriers which have silently and so deeply been erected, which contain the Negro within the economic, political, and social ghettos of his land. Let us know that everything has not been just dandy with the darker brother. Let us do something about his marginal employment, his lack of education, his need for special concentration. For over 340 years, the Negro has been invisible, but he's been here. Perhaps because of the history of disadvantage, he even needs now some special help to compensate for what he has not had. This principle is recognized by educators and is part of a determined program to break down the inequalities of education Northern style. It needs to be done likewise by industry, by labor, and by the political power structure. Yesterday, the President sent to Congress a detailed message labeled the Civil Rights Act of 1963. It contains comprehensive suggestions for legal and voluntary steps to end second-class citizenship. It is, as they say, controversial. If you have not already read it, I believe you should before the day is over. Already, according to the newspapers, the politicians are beginning to play politics with this effort. Senator Dirksen has stated that a filibuster will be employed and that he, the Republican leader of the Senate, will not vote for cloture. A warning, therefore, to all politicians and to both political parties that this may be the last chance. Any political party which does not forthrightly and directly join in the 1963 drive to vindicate the greatness of our constitutional and political system by facing this revolution squarely and honestly will sow the wind, and it will surely reap the whirlwind. I believe we have a chance, and now, and an inescapable obligation to move, and to move now. And I would not wish to see that awful prophecy come true of which Baldwin spoke. God gave Noah the rainbow sign. No more water. Fire next time. I'll answer your questions.
We'll now have the question and answer period sponsored and handled by our president, Dr. Callison.
And now, Mr. Poole, United States District Attorney for this area, if you will come to the lectern with me, we'll get on with the question and answer period. The questions being propounded by the audience who have just listened to your address. We'll start off with this one. Do you approve the Muslim movement, its policies and activities, and is this group helping or hurting the Negro?
Well, I expected this question, and I expected it first, so thank you for not letting me down. I am not an expert on the Muslim, but I do not agree with or condone or believe it to be either justified or practical to talk in terms of hate. I, as a Negro, and generations of Negroes before me, have seen at first hand too much the results of hate. I don't hate you. I hate no one. Now, something else. I think rather than concentrating on the easily discussed statements of Muslim leaders, I think it's more important to consider the conditions which bring the Muslims into existence and which give them a place and an increasing influence in American society. Theirs, I believe, is the result of frustration. They have surrendered to this frustration. They believe, and they are the ones who believe, that you don't mean what you say and you never will. And therefore, their leaders state, let us have somewhere else. Let us go someplace else. Let us flee from this society which is so repressive. But I tell you the significance of 1963 with the American Negro is the very antithesis of the Muslim movement. Because far from being a flight from reality, it is a demand for reality and here and now. And I think it might as well be understood, as the Muslims themselves really know it to be true, that the American Negro is going nowhere. This is home. He's here to stay.
Can we prevent passive resistance from becoming active insurrection? Would not the southern white extremists welcome the latter as justification of their position?
Can we prevent passive resistance from becoming active insurrection? Well, the only insurrection that I am familiar with in the history of this country have all been accomplished by whites. In my home state of Pennsylvania, I remember the whiskey insurrection. I think we had 4 years of it, 1861 to 1865, and some abortive attempt added a couple of weeks ago by a small, short man named Wallace. I cannot speak for what countermeasures may be taken by the Southerners. As to this latter part of the question of whether or not the Southern white extremists would welcome this, I recall Drew Pearson a few days ago stating in his column that this could happen, that demonstrations and overt demands could be met by violence. And Mr. Pearson cautioned the American Negro. He said he must keep in mind that he represents only a tenth. I repeated this to a friend of mine whose answer, if you understand the colloquial, is, not in the world, baby.
This one takes up the matter of responsibility. Why do we hear so much about the Negroes getting extra rights and nothing about their responsibilities?
I haven't yet heard anything about extra rights. We're not asking for extra. We want those that are there. But now, this matter of responsibility deserves a serious answer because it is a thought which I believe permeates the thinking of a great many people. Everyone who claims the rights of citizenship has a correlative duty to exercise and be mindful of its responsibilities. This is true, but you don't start off saying, I would like to have the fruits of citizenship and then get the citizenship. You got to start that tree someplace. What we're talking about here now has nothing at all to do with the quality of people. As a matter of fact, let me assure you that in the 10 years that I served in the district attorney's office and in all the years that Chief Cahill has been here, and I see Frank Brown, who's in the office with me, that there's a great deal of lack of responsibility by people who were by no means Negroes. And any thought that this is a peculiar property of one group in this country simply defies the statistics and the figures. Now, lately there have been some statements in the press that I've seen which talks about the need for cultural adjustment, for education, for obedience to law and order, and things of that kind, with the suggestion that once this comes about, then the Negro will be accorded the rights of full citizenship. I must say that I do believe in the rewards of heaven, and that the result of a good life here on earth will mean heaven. But I'd like to have the good life here while I'm living. And I would like to have someone talk to me in terms of me and not talk to me in terms of mythology or his statistics about somebody else. The fact is that the cold wall, which I say society has erected in large part, does not drop down simply because the man who seeks to enter therein is himself law-abiding, or is educated, or is kind to his children, or doesn't honk his horn in the streets, or any of that sort of thing. So that this is not an answer to the question. This is actually, we believe, an irrelevant question.
Mr. Poole, we'll get a little closer to home with this one. Do you consider San Francisco a city where Negroes are being discriminated against, as recently reported in a local newspaper?
Many of you are in business, I think. How many, may I ask you, how many Negroes do you employ? Or how many have you seen employed and doing what? As you leave here, you will walk up Market Street probably. How many Negroes are employed in the various businesses along Market Street? You are familiar with government. How many Negroes occupy positions of responsibility and great trust in government? How many are part of the policy-making power structure? In San Francisco, how many Negroes occupy major positions in the city, in its government? And for that matter, how many Negro reporters are there in the newspapers here in San Francisco? All of these are questions I would put to you and ask you to draw your own inferences. There is no city, north or south, which does not have guilt upon its hands. San Francisco, as I tried to say in my remarks, is different from Birmingham. It is not Birmingham. Those overt manifestations of discrimination and prejudice are in large and many measures not present here. But they are here. There is a ghetto here. There is a lack of job. There is a lack of education. And there is a bitter and growing frustration in San Francisco. And I don't want to talk about these things in terms of the accusatory finger. I am not interested in that. What I'm trying to make you see is that I believe sincerely that these conditions exist. And if they exist, I am trying to point out our need to do something about them. The only other answer is that which I think so many people fear. The Muslimism. I say we don't need that, and America doesn't want that. This is, despite whatever the courts say, a country whose history is rooted deeply in religion. And if this is true, it perhaps is time that we practice some of it.
Are there sufficient Negro leaders who can guide the Negroes in the right direction?
I think their major problem is trying to catch up with them. Here again, I think the underlying assumption of this question is that there is something occult and mysterious about the Negro, which leads him like a sheep waiting for the bellwether. Or cows, I guess it is, follow blindly where someone starts. The Negro reads. He reads the papers. He knows something about his country. He has some of his own ideas. There are many Negroes who, by education, by character, by training, by their inclination, by their powers of articulation, and by their power of thought, I suppose are as fully equipped, and perhaps no more, certainly no less, than the other so-called leaders in this city. But nobody will lead a people in the right direction except the people themselves. And nobody will lead the American people in the right direction but themselves. Our president, who more than anybody else speaks for us, cannot compel the American leader, American people, to follow in his direction. He can only urge and counsel and point out to them the lessons. And this is true, white and black. Yes, there are Negroes who could go in the right direction, who do head in the right direction, and the Negro people themselves who are certain that they are headed in the right direction.
Are there not Negro colleges in the South that do not accept white students? If this is so, what is the difference between them and Ole Miss?
I'm sure there are, that there are some Negro colleges in the South that do not accept white students, and the reason for that is that if they did, everybody would get arrested, because the custom, the tradition, and the law in those communities forbid them. That's the only answer I can give. As between them and Ole Miss, I can think of a lot of differences, and not all of them can be stated here in polite society.
To what extent does fear of mass Negro action lie behind Southern segregation?
Oh, well, I understand now. I do not come here as the spokesman for white Southern segregation, but there was, it seems to me, a statement in the paper not too long ago, several weeks ago, by Senator Ellender, who stated very frankly that one of the things that they fear is the fact that if the Negro in the South gets the vote, if he is given a real toehold in the economy, business, industry, labor, and the political and social structure, that because of his very numbers, he will dictate and control not only who are the who constitute his government, but the direction in which that government take. I have no doubt but that the basic fear of the segregationist is not that the Negro will marry his daughter, who sometimes is like mine, not even of age yet, but that it is primarily a device to keep him from exercising the ballot, to keep him from being able to run these unrepresentative politicians out of office, and to get rid of by law in the South, backed up by the custom of the ruling authority, the practices of segregation and discrimination.
Does the racial demonstrations help or hinder Negroes' struggle for social and civil equality?
I think the thrust of, I like that word sometimes, the burden of what I've had to say or tried to say has been that I believe the American Negro fully feels, as do many thoughtful political commentators, that without the self-help of the demonstrations and the activities, which 1963 has seen more than ever before, that the Negro would be committed to another 100 or 150 years of gradualism, tokenism, and that these demonstrations have brought about powerful changes in directions in this country, and that they have and will continue to be a potent force in the Negro struggle for equality on all phases.
Should organized Negro groups participate in local citizens' committees set up to work for chosen community relationships?
I do not believe that any responsible Negro or any responsible Negro organization would reject out of hand the opportunity for a meaningful discussion on the problem which beset our country and our nation and our city. As to the direct reference which this question makes to the proposal that was lately put forth by the mayor, I must say that as far as I was able to read in the newspapers the substance of that proposal, I am in some confusion and doubt as to exactly what the mayor proposed to do. As I understand that he proposed three separate groups to be convened in which business people would talk to business people, human and civic rights people would talk to each other, and I suppose the people at City Hall or somewhere would talk to themselves. I am somewhat at a loss to see how this is calculated to really bring about a meaningful change in the situation that we believe requires change here. And so far as that is concerned, I have some strong reservations about its potential utility. But as for the general principle, I have no doubt whatsoever that discussions and dialogue are in order. And I think I ought to say here also that I know a little bit about what actually happened in this situation. I do know, I feel that some of the, if the press quotations are correct, that some of the initial responses to the mayor's suggestion may have been apparently and unfortunately strong. I do know, though, that there is presently underway here in San Francisco a very sincere and determined and quiet effort by the Negro organizations interested in this problem to sit down among themselves and to discuss practical and realistic solutions and proposals with the idea that these proposals and suggestions will be brought to the public attention through biracial commissions or committees or whatever it may be. Now, I personally feel this, that while the president in his address to the mayors in Honolulu urged the formation of biracial committees all over the country, and that a discussion fearlessly and frankly of these problems is in order, that something has got to come from within society itself. And it seems to me that there is no reason here in San Francisco why, A, the people of San Francisco should be ignorant of the facts of racial discrimination in this city, or, B, they should be unwilling themselves to do something about it. One of the basic things that's wrong here is that Negroes can't get jobs, that they have a great problem in getting jobs, and you know that those who have nothing but their common labor to offer are themselves the victims, black and white, of automation. And this means that there's got to be something more than somebody saying, I'm going to put a token clerk in my store tomorrow morning. I think it's going to require some real solid thinking by business and labor and government. And I think that this is going to be in the interest of us all, because you are wasting a great labor force. You are simply rejecting it. You say, maybe they're not equipped for it. Get them equipped. Maybe they're not educated for it. Give them the education. Maybe they need retraining. Maybe they need some additional vocational guidance. The point is that whatever else there is to be done, it ought to be done. And this should not be and cannot be, and I think it dare not be, simply a gesture that is made for people to talk, to say a few kind words, and then go back. I think the situation, as the president and almost every other responsible person has characterized it, is far too serious. And this is what I think has to be done. Now, if the mayor's proposal is a start toward this, then I would welcome that and any other start. But I suggest that there ought to be some dialogues going on now among the people who themselves have the capacity to do something about this situation. Wherever it starts, it should be deep. I think that answers.
This question takes an important viewpoint. What is being done within the Negro community toward self-development of its own great capabilities?
Well, you and I, the writer of this question, are going to have to do some very serious studying of history. I think you have to be acquainted with the fact that there exist institutions in the Negro community, if I can use that term to make it meaningful, that it is composed of people like you and like me who have families, who raise their children, who support them, who paint their houses, pay their taxes, don't throw garbage in the streets, who go to their jobs or their positions, who work hard, who go to church, who want to bring up themselves and their neighbors, who want to live in this country, to make it good for them, who hope that their children will be better as they go along, and who believe sincerely that these kids in school, these youngsters, are going to have a better life than they have, and who therefore are doing what man has done ever since he crawled out of a hole in a cave or came down from the tree. He has lived his life as fully as he can. And this is what develops one's capacities when one is not arbitrarily restricted. This is the capacity developing characterization of mankind. Yes, this is being done in the Negro community, and I should say that you can take off the blinders and see that this is true, that you not only read in the papers about crime in the Fillmore, but you also understand what moves a Negro, for example, to sacrifice his money, to send his money to the people in the South because he thinks that they need it too, to empathize with them, to want to see something done. This is what you have to understand when you're talking about development of one's own capacities. But it needs something else. It needs the removal of some pretty formidable and some pretty difficult barriers.
The Commonwealth Club of California thanks you very much, United States Attorney Cecil F. Poole, for a very interesting and informative discussion on the matter of the relationships between the white and the Negro of our community. The meeting stands adjourned.
This is Stuart Richardson Ward, and across the microphone from me sits the Honorable Cecil F. Poole, United States Attorney of San Francisco, who spoke before the weekly general meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California here in the Gold Ballroom of the Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco. And his topic was the Negro and equal justice. Mr. Poole, in your opening remarks, you told of how your little girl who was watching the television screen from Birmingham, Alabama, and where the Negroes parading there were crying, freedom, freedom, freedom. One little girl, one of your daughters asked the other, what do they mean? And before you could answer, the other little daughter said, they mean that they want to be treated like all people should be treated and not just like they don't belong here. Now, I think from your audience reception and applause today and from your own conversation with many people, both of the Negro race and of the Caucasian race, you know that there are millions of people that feel in the friendly and constructive way. Isn't it true, Mr. Poole, that when we get down to cases, that the practical means of achieving these things is the real headache for all of us?
Yes, I think that this is the necessity for all of us, to find practical ways of achieving the theories which we have fairly fully embraced in the North and which the courts have espoused for us in the South. But the real problem that we have is that although the principles of equality of opportunity and freedom are clear now by virtue of our Constitution and I suppose by the American ethic, it is still also true that widespread, North and South, the Negro finds himself the victim of grossly differential treatment, and that in major aspects of American life, he finds that he is, in fact, excluded. This is housing, this is jobs, this is political participation, this is the entire spectrum of American life. And it is the accomplishment of these goals and objectives as a real, a meaningful fact of life that the Negro is now struggling.
Well, as you say, Mr. Poole, it has been an objective of the Negro race ever since they were first brought to this country to achieve many of these fine objectives which are now being worked for so vigorously. Your interviewer remembers when the books of oratory by the great Negro orator Douglas. I remember the life of George Washington Carver and his great accomplishments and inventions in the field of the uses of the sweet potato, for example, and other products in the Deep South. And particularly I remember Booker T. Washington, whom my parents took me to hear along with the Tuskegee Singers way back in 1910 and earlier. All of those men have worked towards this fine and important objective of getting equality that they are entitled to. What methods have they used so far, and what do you think of those methods?
Well, very many whites are able to reel off names like Booker Washington, Ralph Bunche, Marian Anderson, Joe Lewis. But all people are not Booker T. Washingtons or George Washington Carver or Marian Andersons or Joe Lewis and all that. And the important thing today to the Negro is not to be told that such and such was a champion or such and such was a great scientist. The important thing for him is that he has a chance to realize whatever his potential is. Not many of us are going to be like Carver, white or black.
Well, Joe, Cecil, I didn't have in mind particularly the use of those names, but I did have in mind that this desire and effort, which is now manifest in these parades, has always been with us in the heart of the Negro. And I wondered if you would comment on the methods, or lack of methods, which have been used by all Negroes in an effort to achieve their just rights.
Well, if I understand you, Stu, on this, I would say that Birmingham is new. That Birmingham is more dramatic, Birmingham was an outburst, but that there has been deep in the heart of the Negro for generations upon generations this frustration and this desire to escape from shackles that are in large measure imposed upon him, both by either a hostile or an indifferent society, in part by his own lack of education based upon his lack of opportunity in major respects, and upon his own lack of stature and position in the community in which he lives. And whereas for the first 100 years since the Emancipation Proclamation, the Negro concentrated his efforts on having established, and this had to be established for people, that the constitutional guarantees and the principles of the Declaration are meaningful and apply to him. So he's gone through the courts, and he's fought his battle in the courts and up to the Supreme Court in transportation and in equality of state treatment and in voting, the suffrage, due process, and that sort of thing. And now the courts have done this, but the Negro still finds himself shackled in major respects.
So and in now, connection with those shackles, Cecil, could I ask you to repeat what you just said to the Commonwealth Club of California so vividly? Because, frankly, I never heard it so accurately described as you did. Take specifically the matter of the travel conditions under which Negroes have had to travel in trains.
Well, of course, in large respects, that has now been struck down by the court. But the so-called separate but equal doctrine, which was both pernicious and untrue, because while there was separation, there was never equality in facilities of transportation. The Negro rode in the Jim Crow car, which was placed next to the engine. They were never air-conditioned. The cinders came in. They dirtied his clothes, the seats, the floor. They got in his eyes. They struck him across the face. It was hot and humid, and the facilities were broken down and untended. And this is the sort of thing that the Negro had to grow up with. Now the courts have said that interstate transportation can no longer be separate. And now the courts have said that trains and airline and bus waiting rooms must be desegregated. And these are the obvious things of travel, of the peripheries of life, which are important. But I think basics do, and basic to these drives in the South, what the people mean by freedom now, is full participation in government. They want jobs, they want housing, they want good schools, they want an opportunity to assure their children that tomorrow is going to be better than was yesterday.
And you noted, Cecil, that the South had scorned and bullied and openly denied the Negro citizenship, and then you made some comments on the Northerners. I think sometimes we in the North feel kind of superior to the South in our treatment of Negroes. What was your comment on the Northern
attitude? The North has always felt superior in its treatment to Negroes to the South because it could always point to the overt hostility and denials of the South and not having to recognize its own. But the North has been quite indifferent to the Negro. He's been the last to be hired and the first to be fired. And he's been discriminated against in assignment and upgrading and promotions. And he's been kept in the economically and industrially in the lowest categories. And now with the threat of automation, Stu, coming along, this problem can no longer be faced.
You got twice as many unemployed Negroes percentage-wise than you have white men.
Everywhere the percentage is at least twice.
At least twice. And then you referred, Cecil Poole, in talking to the Commonwealth Club of California just now, to the fundamentals which the Negro aims at, and perhaps it would be helpful if you would enumerate specifically what are the fundamentals as your people view them and for which they are working now.
I think the fundamentals at which he aims are the same fundamentals at which everybody else aims, and that is the right to enjoy fully and thoroughly the entire society of which he is a part and to be a part of it. The right to hold a job, to buy a house, to go to school, to ride, to live, to work, to be a part of everything without discriminations based upon the fact and the accident of his birth or his color. He wants to be an American. He wants to be an American citizen here and now. And no other Americans on this land, Stu, would allow themselves to be differentially treated without struggling against it.
And you write a quotation from the San Francisco newspaper to which you referred, written by Eric Severide, and I think that was so poignant and so succinct. Would you like to read it on the air?
Yes, Eric Severide, who is a very profound thinker, wrote last Sunday these words in part, "However painful this is for most of us, the plain truth is that the American Negro has, at long, long last, lost faith in the white man and his society. He no longer believes the words of promise. He no longer believes that the laws will be enforced unless he himself forces their enforcement. This is what the most patient and enduring of American races has come to. And we who are white have no one to blame but ourselves. There is no place to hide anymore."
And in your closing portion of your address to the Commonwealth Club, you made a concrete statement which you considered was a needed warning with regard to politicians who might wish to play with this issue for their own personal advantage, Cecil.
Yes. the President and the Attorney General of this great country have been doing all they can in recent days to try to alert this country to the problems which it faces and the threats that are inherent in those problems. And on yesterday, President John Kennedy sent to Congress a detailed message which is labeled the Civil Rights Act of 1963. It contains comprehensive suggestions for legal and voluntary steps to end second-class citizenship. And it's controversial, but already the politicians are beginning to play politics with this effort. The newspapers indicate that Senator Everett Dirksen has stated that if the filibuster will be employed and that he, the Republican leader of the Senate, will not vote for cloture. As you know, cloture is necessary in order to shut off debate, in order to force or to give the Senate a chance to go on record and to vote on these measures. And I say that the politicians and both political parties ought to be warned that this may be their last chance, and that any political party, Republican or Democrat, which does not forthrightly and directly join in the 1963 drive by Negroes and by the President to vindicate the greatness of our constitutional and political system, by facing this revolution squarely and honestly, will sow the wind and they will reap the whirlwind. And I think we have a chance and an obligation to move and to move now.
And now shall we go to one or two of the questions which were asked of you by members of the Commonwealth Club from the floor. One was with respect to the black Muslim movement and according to articles in two of our leading magazines or more, this movement is dedicated to an irrevocable hatred of the white man and a desire for complete separation and independence rather than integration. What are your own views, Cecil Poole, on the Muslim movement?
I think in this regard that my views accord very largely with those of most Negroes in this country. And that is, first of all, that they're not interested in going somewhere else. They don't want any separate state or land. They've been separate too long. They want to be a part of this entire country and all of it. That theirs is not hate, but it is frustration. And it is the bitterness of frustration and despair which has given rise to the Muslim movement and which gives it some voice and some standing. But these people have completely lost faith, and they think that the white man will never live up to his promises, and therefore they are surrendering and yielding to that despair.
And your comment, Cecil, upon the need for the Negro to assume responsibilities in the view of some, as well as to ask for additional or what we call extra benefits.
Well, Stu, the Negro has never asked for any extra benefits. The Negro has only asked that this country mean what it has said in its Constitution, its Declaration of Independence, what it means by due process and the equality of opportunity. What the Negro wants is the enjoyment of those rights as a man because he was born here, and he has the same right to that as does the white. You don't take the rights away from a white man because he may be immoral or because he may be dirty or uneducated or diseased. What you say to him is, if you're immoral, straighten up. If you're diseased, get cured, and if you're dirty, clean up. That's all the Negro can expect to have happen to him.
And what do you think about conditions in San Francisco in a sentence or two, Cecil?
Well, I think San Francisco shares the problems and burdens of most northern communities. That is, that discrimination here is not overt and easy as it is in the South, but discrimination exists in jobs and employment, it exists in political activity, and it's right here, Stu. We've got to clean that up also.
Thank you very much, Cecil Poole. And now I'm embarrassed to announce who your speaker will be for the Commonwealth Club a week from today, the same time, the same station. Your interviewer, Stuart Richardson Ward, will be interviewing, or rather will be speaking on the topic, Notes on Germany, as seen in May 1963. Thank you again very much, Cecil Poole.